Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Hey, Kathleen.
Welcome to another week of transmission. This is episode 211.
211.
I mean, the next big one is 250. Like, that's like a
quarter of a millennium.
Yeah. Think we'll ever get to 1,000?
No.
I think our children will have to carry on.
There we go.
Good morning.
Hey, Dorit.
Yeah, Dorinda and Karen, good morning. And everybody else watching. today we're, you know, Dan and I were thinking, you know, like, we should try to talk about something life-affirming and positive.
Really upbeat.
We can talk about climate change. before we talk about everyone's favorite topic, like, and this is the thing, this is like the big, there are all sorts of crappy things in the world, but I think this one feels the most overwhelming to a lot of people because it's so, it's global in scope.
It's the whole planet.
And it seems like it's harder to reverse than a lot of other problems, where the problem is a lack of will. But here there's a lack of will, plus there's undoable damage. I mean, I guess in a way, all injustice has a little bit of that quality. Like, we know that oppression and trauma can kind of be passed on genetically, but this is like a big one. This is a big one. But we have to start talking about it because our nation is baking, and we have to start thinking about, like, what is it that causes us to shut down? What do we do about this? But before we dive into this fun topic, we should introduce ourselves. I'm Mark Vinstinok. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
And I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing. And So this is a topic I think about all the time, have been thinking about for decades. That's sort of the main focus of my latest book.
Do you have a copy of that book laying around for promotional purposes?
I do.
You got to do the hustle.
Got to do the hustle. Okay.
If the world's going to die anyways, you might as well make a little bit of money.
Yeah. Creation's wisdom.
Spiritual practice and climate change.
Yeah. And, and obviously as this summer has gotten going, and it only turned summer today, although it feels like it's been summer for quite a while now. Mm-hmm. And half of the United States is in severe drought conditions. Minnesota is sort of right on the edge of that.
They can't definitely fireworks.
Yeah, it's definitely in drought. I think it hasn't quite been labeled severe, except in some parts of the state. But there's some really, crazy things starting to happen, right? I mean, I'm from out west, so I'm very familiar with both Lake Mead and the Oroville Reservoir in California. And both of these are drying up. They're drying up. And the thing is that between those two reservoirs, both in terms of water, in terms of electricity, like 25 million people depend on those in one way or another. And so, this idea that, these things are just drying up and they're not going to be able to produce power, and water, if water doesn't flow out of Lake Mead, it means the Colorado River dries up, because that's a dam on the Colorado River. So everything downstream, like, there's no more rafting through the Grand Canyon or anything like that. And it's so hot that, we were sort of laughing about this. This is, really sort of horrible humor. But I mean, it's so hot in Arizona now that people are talking about the fact that If you have any exposed skin on the sidewalk, you get burned. You know, you get these third degree burns. And so, like, if you fall over on the sidewalk, you know, you just start getting burned all over.
It's like, you know, it's darkly humorous, but like the idea of like you're trying to push yourself up with and you're just getting burned more and more is horrible.
Yeah, it's horrible.
But it's kind of it's so absurd that there's a dark humor to it.
Yeah, so these things are going on right in front of us, and yet at the same time there is this very strange to me anyway phenomenon of the vast majority of people sort of trying to continue on as if everything is just normal.
or this weird belief that somehow we'll just get through it. It's kind of like this sort of like it's like a grandparent who's been through the Depression kind of thing. Like, well, we've been through hard things before. We can be through anything. Like that kind of mentality, which doesn't really work. And kind of the weird way that we were talking before, like nothing embodies the naive and dangerous, stupidly optimistic way that people are approaching this. Like the current billionaire race to go into space. Like, you know, we used to have like, remember back in the good old days of the Cold War when it was like Sputnik, you know, they were the first satellite in space and the United States had to catch up.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, at least it was two nations. Now there's like billionaires are fighting, like Bezos, Elon Musk, some Russian guy, I can't remember his name. And then like, who's the British guy who runs Virgin? Richard Branson or whatever. Like these guys are all trying to go into space. And you know, Musk has talked about colonizing the solar system. And you know, that's directly connected to climate change. It's this idea of that, you know, well, there's other planets if we screw this one up.
And then there's also, you know, the movie Elysium, right? Mm-hmm. Where basically the rich people live in a ring up in the sky, and you know, we don't have to worry about criticizing the police force because they're all robots that will just, you know, crush your head if you say the wrong thing to them.
That's why we need Matt Damon to save us all. I think Matt Damon, he's the I love the fact that we live in a world where Matt Damon is an action star. Because let's just be honest. If there's a Hollywood actor that's just kind of like a regular looking person, Matt Damon is kind of he's handsome, but he's like regular guy handsome. And he hasn't got this chiseled physique. So maybe if we can live in a world where Matt Damon can be an action star, maybe we can beat climate change.
Maybe we have hope. Anything's
possible.
All right, we got some comments coming in, which is great.
Series writes, climate change, nothing brings up our own collective shit than that. I mean, it's definitely up there. Ellen writes, I've got family who live in Oroville. The difference between 2002 and 2021 in the reservoir is striking.
It is striking. It's like, I mean, some of these pictures are just unbelievable. I mean, they really are. They're just unreal. What's going on out there?
Kathleen writes, they've been telling us in Missouri not to walk our dogs on the street because the asphalt is hot enough to burn their paws. We have been setting record high temps for June.
Right. I mean, which again, when you think about it, so like think about, right, people have dogs. You got to walk your dog. Like, so suddenly it's too hot to walk your dog. what are you supposed to do? Like, just let your dog take a dump in the house? I mean, what if you don't have a backyard? What if you don't have a house? What if you live in an apartment? It's like, okay, well, now we got to kill all the dogs because we can't walk them because it's too hot outside.
This is where capitalism steps in, Dan, because I bet you there's going to be this new market for
doggy
pet treadmills.
treadmills. Okay, that's the expensive version. I was thinking like little fireproof doggy boots. You've got to buy those. Well,
yours is probably more cost effective, but mine is more for the elite market.
Yeah, exactly.
Guest writes, maybe a few of them will go into space and not come back. I mean, we're going to talk more about the psychology of this as the series goes on, but I will say this, it's interesting. Like, so there's this petition for Jeff Bezos not coming back. That's the,
well, and Ellen's comment on Ellen, apparently this is actually a real thing, I guess.
Yeah. Have you seen the petition to not let Jeff Bezos back to the planet once he leaves? I've signed that petition. And so the funny thing is, it's like, it's funny, but let's just look at it. It's like, one, it's funny to do that. Two, it is kind of, we recognize the symbolic power of Jeff Bezos as a billionaire who's representing this sort of naive hope in capitalism. And it's the point where, like, yes, it's funny, I've signed it too, but really, what a powerless and kind of impotent act that is. Like, we're in a stage where we do more and more of these impotent acts that can't really challenge anything, that have symbolic power, because at a certain point you can only just laugh and cry at the same time.
Right.
And so Jeff Bezos going to, like, he embodies the sort of climate change concern, because that's why billionaires are in a space race now. It's because they want to extract resources from other places.
Well, or to have a place to escape to. I mean, I feel like, you know, they're not admitting that, but I'm completely convinced that that's part of this, right? I mean, once going to your island is not viable because, like, the sea level has risen and your island is now underwater, you got to have someplace else to go if you're a billionaire. And so space is the logical place. And yeah, and there's all this focus on different planets and different things, but, you know, the idea of this orbiting ecosystem where you can just escape to, this is, to me, not an unrealistic conversation that I would not be at all surprised that these people are having.
Yep. And the and there's a reason I think they're not doing just space station stuff. Like, because if I were a rich guy, I wouldn't want to be dependent on the Earth for my resources, because a strike could kill me. That's why they're going to, like, talking about mining water from asteroids is something that there's active conversations about. Or, like, yay, there's maybe a hidden, there's like oceans of frozen water underneath the surface of Mars. Like, and they get excited about that, because if there's water there and you can create some sort of biome, then you can do all the stuff from there.
Set up shop.
You know, that's kind of cool from a science fiction level, but it's just this recognition, like, somehow at some point you'd think it'd be more cost effective to fix this planet that already has life than try to figure out how to populate another planet. Mm-hmm. So this hedging of bets is kind of terrifying to me.
Yeah. Well, and it is. I think to me, what's interesting about this, and I've always felt this way about, you know, these super progressy things that we want to put billions of dollars into, as opposed to, like, first making sure that everybody has a home and healthcare and food. I think that it really shows something about the mindset that it is less interesting to these people to engage in care than it is to go into outer space and build a space station, right? And I was just reading this article about Amazon the other day where it said that, you know, one of the things is that Bezos thinks that people are fundamentally lazy and want to take advantage of him, and that's why he regulates them in their factories, right? And so, you know, he clearly has this incredibly negative, sort of horrible view of people, which is one of the things then that, you know, I'm sure consciously or unconsciously just justifies exploitation And, you know, why would you want to set up systems of care for people if you just believe they're lazy and they're going to take advantage of you? Some more comments.
Tyler writes, one of my favorite comic memes is the dog sitting around drinking coffee and his house is on fire and burning all around him. And he just nonchalantly says, this is fine. That's a classic. Yeah. It's a great metaphor for a lot of things these days.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, yes. Ceres writes, how do we deal with the denialism in our communities in one hand? How do we also deal with the fact that a lot of mainstream environment movement is dominated by middle class, ableist, low-key, eco-fascist white folks, which is not the people you want to lead the climate change movement? I mean, that's some of the direction I think we're going to go as the week continues, this yeah. issue of denialism, the issue of how the environmental struggle has been captivated by whiteness. And then there's the eco-fascist expression of that, which, you know, we have Handmaid's Tale as an example of eco-fascism, but there's lots of movements around eco-fascism that are overt and some that are a little bit more mm-hmm. subtle, and it's terrifying.
Yeah. You know, and the thing, Tyler, that you bring up with that meme and that we're kind of talking about, I mean, this is a very age-old kind of struggle and issue, right? So if you look at the biblical prophetic tradition, and the way that this is shown most clearly is in Jeremiah. So in that prophetic tradition, you often have two types of prophets. Again, if prophets are people who are assessing what's going on and perhaps making some future predictions, but more just looking at the reality of what's happening, right? So you have the positive prophets, who basically, you know, are like the dog in the meme. We're just like, no, everything's fine. You know, you guys are doing a good job. The king's doing a good job. Everybody's, you know, everything's kind of going okay. God's very happy with what you're doing. And then you've got the other prophets who, not coincidentally, are the ones whose books actually end up in the Bible, who are basically the ones saying, no, things are not okay. Like, things are completely screwed up and you guys are going to get wiped out. And so in Jeremiah, there's actually this battle between these two prophets. So you've got Jeremiah and you've got Baruch, who's the positive prophet. And they're, you know, going back and forth, sort of arguing in front of the king. And of course, Jeremiah is the one that is correct. But, you know, I think that this just reflects and it's not just two sides of humanity, but it really is this issue of, you know, do we want to look at things as they really are? Or do we want to look at things in a way that just makes us feel better? And I think that that's an enormous part of what's happening with this climate crisis, because there is this incredible desire and this thing that we're seeing of millions, if not billions, of people looking at this and basically going like, well, yeah, things are kind of weird. Some bad things are happening, but it's basically okay. We don't have to change.
Mm-hmm. Gus writes, we should mention, this is a whole other thing, the way we've been told that the consumer is responsible for climate change. It's absolutely depressing, disempowering that I can change light bulbs as if that's on the same scale as society moving from fossil fuels, etc. It's amazing to me like how this works, because if anytime I point this sort of thing out, people get upset because it... We feel so impotent about it that we latch on to these symbolic gestures of recycling, composting, light bulbs, which I do those things. Like, I'm not like dumping oil on my lawn because I don't care. Like, I care so much that I recognize we need systemic change. And the issue is the people who have power in the system have been pushing the sense of responsibility to people who have less power in the system. So then, and this is for everything. So like now we have, if you talk about the inavailability of accessible food, healthy food for people as a systemic problem, people will start getting upset and saying, no, it's fatty needs to figure out how to eat better. Like that's what they want to shift the responsibility of the individual. Same with recycling, pollution, climate change, every issue. Like this is what our society does par excellence is shift the responsibility to the individual. There's all kinds of studies on this. And this is a great example of that. Like you could, every regular individual consumer could change their habits and we would probably still have these problems because this is more than just the sum total of individual consumer choices. It's the system providing these things and we're acting as though we can actually choose something other than this. It's, I mean, it's a big complicated issue when it comes to, you know, and this is a system.
Well, yeah, but I think the other piece to that, Mark, though, is that, and this to me is really where this issue is just should be very clear and obvious to people. Like there are choices that are not available.
That's right.
Right. So when you say the consumer could change, no, I mean, you cannot buy a car that gets 100 miles to the gallon. Mm-hmm. You cannot buy that. So you can't make that choice. Right. And so, you know, I think that that to me is really the place where this all gets hidden is you pretend, oh, well, the consumer could make all these great different choices. But the real important choices are actually not available. Like in America, you can't function really well on public transportation. You don't have that choice. Like, you know, so we have a retreat center in Northwest Minnesota. I can't take the train there. Like I would like to be able to take the train there.
You can't even take the train to like within striking distance of there.
Well, you can take it to Grand Forks, North Dakota, which is within striking distance, but the train service is so bad that it's regularly 6 to 10 hours late. You can't rely on it. It's horrible. It leaves at like 2 o'clock in the morning. I mean, it's completely unworkable, right? You can barely even take a bus there, right? Like there is only this weird local bus that takes 11 hours to get from Minneapolis to Crookston. I mean, it's just not workable. So the system blocks us from making choices that would be beneficial. And, you know, the example that I bring up all the time, because I was alive then. So the first oil crisis was in 1972. And at that point, there were, you know, a small number of folks who were advocating for all of these systemic changes. You know, let's invest in really efficient cars. Let's get into alternative energies. Let's do... You know, there's a whole slate of things, systemic things. You know, let's require that in 10, 15 years, we have cars that get 50, 60 miles to the gallon. All of that stuff was rejected, right? Now, if we had done all those things, we would be in a completely different place right now, right? The notion that consumers can fix this would be predicated on the fact that they would have the options to fix this, which we don't. So it's really should be a non-conversation.
Mm-hmm. Maria writes, Lake Michigan is at record high level. There's some discussion about shipping the water out west. Water rights are going to be a very hot political issue. Yes. In some ways they already are.
Yeah, but they're
it's going to intensify because like, you know, we're already, I mean, it's been in the news the last few years. More and more how water is being treated like a ownable resource, yeah. Like water rights, like Nestle, that sort of stuff. I mean, that's where it's going to go. I mean, we already have this with like pipelines and cutting across water rights. We've had, you know, the whole issue around water is not a new thing, but it's going to get worse. And, you know, this is where I remember when I first started being like shifting away from climate change denialism, which I used to not believe it because I was a young conservative. And I remember watching that movie Escape from New York and there's a sequel, Escape from LA. And in that post-apocalyptic wasteland, Minneapolis is the nation's capital. And I've often thought about that because I'm like, it makes sense because we've got a lot of water up here that at some point, and we've already seen this with the pipelines and Standing Rock, which is next door, like, this is going to be a horrible place for political political violence to happen around water. And it's already started. I mean, this is what a lot of these issues around indigenous rights have been about. Gus writes, this is an ad campaign especially made by oil companies, big tobacco, et cetera. It's your job to make your own changes, not the industry. But really, scientific reality is unknowable. That's the messaging, yeah. Yes.
Yeah,
for sure. Ellen writes, forget the death penalty versus abortion. The pro-life movement needs to address climate change and the greed of billionaires.
That would be nice.
I mean, that's what you get in Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah.
I thought we've been shopping water for years. That's
Yeah, I mean, the you know, the issue of controlling water is a major one and a major part of this, and because not the least of which is obviously as things warm up, water evaporates more quickly, right? And so one of the things about Lake Mead, for example, is that you know, there's 6 feet worth of water that evaporates every year, which is an astronomical amount of water. And, you know, and so controlling this more and more is definitely going to be a big focus. Ellen asked the question, did they add water to the Wall Street commodities last year? Not Wall Street, it's the Chicago Board of Exchange, yeah, as a commodity, which is going to be a disaster. But it's absolutely predictable in terms of this capitalist march to, you know, it's just endless control and money making for small percentages of people.
Mm-hmm. Ellen writes, I'm guessing you can get from Minneapolis to Crookston in less than 11 hours by driving.
Yes, you can. It's about 4.5 hours if you drive.
No. Maria writes, sort of, there's Nestle that bottles lots of water. I think there are engineering plants to pipe water. Yeah, I think it's just going to intensify. I think you're exactly right. Like this, this doesn't seem to be going in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in many places, it's illegal to collect rainwater, which is really amazing when you think about it, right? I mean, that's a level of water control that is quite astonishing.
Sarah's writes, I don't know how to pronounce this. Fuck this idea that water is ownable. I mean, this is, oh my God. This is when you start talking about the ownability of water, you can start seeing this unbroken chain of conquest driven by control of land, resources, and labor, right? This is this is continuity with the conquest of the so-called New World in order for land and riches, and the capitalist system that developed out of colonization and alongside it, so you can control bodies, and controlling even ever more resources like water that falls from the sky is the continuation of this logic of supremacy, conquest, and dominance. And so this is where it really becomes a pressing issue, like Sarah's brought up earlier. I think it was you, right, Sarah's, that talked about the whiteness of this all. Mm-hmm. And that this isn't just about like, oh, these social justice warriors want to like get in on the climate change action and aren't content just arguing about racism, is not, which is, I've heard people frame it that way, which is ridiculous. No, it's a recognition that there's a pathology here that was part of the development of whiteness, mm-hmm. right? And so, like, we should be skeptical of white conditioned, white malformed peoples in and our middle class consciousness dominating the conversation around climate change. It's, you know, it's kind of like no duh, but some people really don't like that kind of talk for some reason. Maria writes, the organic food industry is an example of how consumer choices have opened up opportunities for more organic choices availability. Well, yeah, and then it's also where you see companies trying to get deceitful about what's right. organic or not as kind of, again, this pushback. Like, yeah. this is the thing. Whenever we do get some meaningful choices that actually could do stuff, some of those choices are taken away from us.
This co-opted.
Co-opted. Yeah. It's a great example. Like,
yeah. Well, and this is the paradox, and Maria's got another comment about this. I mean, it's very important to have, clarity and nuance about this, right? This yeah. interaction between the individuals and the system. When we say that consumer choices right now could not change climate change, what we're talking about is the limitation of massive individual choices in the yeah. face of certain systemic realities. We're not saying that individual choice is not important. And we're not saying that people do not have a lot of power, especially collectively. both things are true, right? Mm-hmm. Both things are true. And, you know, and we're going to talk about this a lot more as the week goes on, but to me, this is kind of a good place to end, because people will, of course, always say, well, what do you do? Mm-hmm. And I think that what you do, to me, is that we really, whoever the we is, and if it's only two or three people or five or 10 people, fine, whatever. Whoever the we is, we need to get very serious about engaging a different relationship with ourselves and each other and with the world. Hmm. And is that going to fix global climate change tomorrow? No, absolutely not. And I think that's the important reality to acknowledge. But is it going to perhaps sow seeds for something else? Is it going to perhaps help those few people who are engaged in that? Yes. Absolutely will. Will it serve perhaps as an example or an object lesson? It will. And so we do both. We recognize the powerlessness of the moment, and we also embrace the power that we do have.
And this comment from Maria, I think it kind of gets at that. Like, I disagree with that personal choices don't have power against the system. It is the grassroots power of people willing to sacrifice convenience to live according to their values that changes systems. And part of the thing, like, in that sentence, I feel like you're pointing at what we're trying to get at. Like, you shifted from personal to grassroots. Once you start talking about grassroots, you're not talking about the sum total of individual choices detached from one another. As though I'm recycling and I've done my part. Once you start talking grassroots, you're starting to say we are recycling and we're coming up with ways to do this together. So, like, there is this collective assumption, and the relationship between the two is something that I think you're right. We have to talk about it. Like, we have to figure out what we can do individually, what choices we can meaningfully make that open up more choices. Because otherwise, what's the alternative? You sit back and you hope you'll rely on some other system that we don't have a lot of choice in, the electoral system. Where we're made to think we have lots of choices, but we're only given a couple, and then hope like we vote for one of them and they'll change it. Like, that's not doable either. Other comments.
We got to blaze through the comments, and we'll have more time to talk about stuff.
Mm-hmm. Sarah writes, even if scientific knowledge is unknowable, we still need to have a better relationship to our resources and ecosystem, regardless. Sarah's writes, why is it that some developed nations are able to be technologically advanced and environmentally conscious, yet Americans can't seem to figure this out? Good question.
Good thing to talk about.
Ellen writes, people are mostly water. Does this commodifying water mean we'll all become worth the water in our bodies?
Right. Yeah.
Sell your water. Oh. Yeah. Gus writes, we should also mention who's going to pay the price for these systems. I'm headed out with cold drinks today to hand out to folks living outside. Folks living with the lowest carbon footprint in the Western world are going to suffer first. Yes.
Yeah, that's true across the globe.
Angelique writes, or Angelic, I don't know how to pronounce your name, I'm sorry. It's easier to blame and put responsibility on ordinary people because the leaders don't want to risk upsetting the true power holders, those who have the machinery to put leaders in place of power or remove them when they don't serve the purposes of those who have control of the system. Yes. Final comments. Oh, two. Timothy, for many years I lived in Delaware. I used to laugh at people who spoke of climate change as something in the future. We were losing beach area and marshland every year to rising sea levels, and flood zones were constantly being updated from 100-year to 50-year and 50-year to 25-year, et cetera. For the sea level states like Delaware, climate change is now. Well, not even just sea level states. Like, so Minnesota, we're in the middle of the continent, and we can see, like we've talked about this all the time, like you can grow corn further north than ever before. The moose population is being decimated. Like whole sections of the state, the lakes are considered unsafe for swimming. This is all part of the whole system. And then, you know, of course, we're having droughts. These sorts of migration patterns are going to shift. Disease ranges are going to shift. It's just, Gus writes, folks outside of the West are going to get it even worse. Small island nations in the Pacific are screwed.
Yep.
Yay, good point to end on. positive talk.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for hanging in there with us. As we've said, we're going to be reflecting on this all week. There's lots to look at. And, we'll see you later.
If there's a world Wednesday, we'll see you then.
Bye.